Welcoming to Radio Gorgeous, Kirsty Gunn, author of Caroline's Bikini. And we're going to start with her reading a passage from Caroline's Bikini.
Most of the strong feelings we have go unspoken, I agreed one evening in the kind of place where I should have been wearing a little black dress. I remember we were sitting quite close together on two very spindly little chairs. It was like we were trying to keep our balance. Most of the important thoughts we have about our lives, we don't say them out loud, I continued, the fine and precarious structure of the chair wavering beneath me. But that's not the point, Evan, I said. The fact is that people, when they read, want to read something that has substance and ballast. I was back on the theme of content. Less introspection, more action had been my driving thoughts ever since Evan had given me pages about his sense of, as he described it, the real. For that kind of thinking would not our story make, was how I saw it, and I wanted to have him see it too. Readers like resolution, conflict, drama, I went on, and you're talking about making this into a novel, your situation in Richmond, and what you think about the situation, but I have my challenges with that. Story or not, Evan, or novel, to use your new term, we still need a proper plot here. That's what people want from the genre, narrative, drama and action, and maybe some research too, you know, historical research. Don't get me wrong, I'm committed. As I've said, it won't stop me writing, wondering whether people will find this interesting or not. The project is interesting, I think, and it's building up. We have the whole first section done. But novel, Evan. If it's a novel, readers will want more. They'll want more than you seeing Caroline Beresford in a Richmond doorway. Novels want more. Finished off my drink and stood to get another round in.
Excellent. That is a wonderful introduction to the primary voice of the novel, which is Emily. Could you tell us more about Caroline's Bikini, also subtitled An Arrangement of a Novel with an Introduction and Some Further Material?
Yeah, well, as you said, Emily is our narrator, and that's her voice you heard there. Emily's frustrated with Evan because Evan Gordonston, who's her very best friend, they've known each other since they were five, has come back from the States where he's been living, and he's looking for somewhere to stay in London. And through a friend of a friend, he's become a lodger in a rather grand house in Richmond and has fallen head over heels with his landlady there, the glamorous Caroline Beresford. And on the basis of that, he wants to make an entire novel about his love for her, and he's asked Emily to write it. Now, poor Emily is a kind of a bit of a failed short story writer. I think she's had one or two things published, but chiefly she writes copy for advertising companies and this kind of thing. She's very nervous about the idea of taking on a big love story, and on top of that, there doesn't seem to be a huge amount going on in Richmond between Evan and Caroline. So she's trying to find a way of bringing from scant material, Evan keeps providing her pages and notes and details of what's going on there, but she's struggling to make that into a novel.
And these friends meet regularly, continuously, to pour over this material, and as an opportunity, as anyone in love loves to do, to talk about their love endlessly and in great detail, despite there really not being very much detail, over endless gin and tonics throughout the summer.
Yeah.
And it is that unrequited love, and then, which is totally oblivious, and then in the mirror of that, Emily as amanuensis becomes clearer, and she becomes revealed, and sort of her mirrored unrequited feelings, and the perfection of unrequited love, the utter, you get to enjoy all of those feelings of love without having to do bugger all about it. You can be a coward. So talk to me, I know I've just said a whole bunch of things there, but talk to me about some of unpicking some of the fun of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The huge amount of the novel takes place in various pubs around London where Evan and Emily get together. And I love this piece that's just come out in New Zealand, written by... I've just lost the page. Written by Vincent O'Sullivan, a wonderful novelist and critic and scholar. And he's written this that makes me laugh. I remember the first time I read Emma, finding it hard to believe that so many cups of tea could be drunk in one novel, even by ladies who didn't need to work for a living. I thought of that, how could one not, as I read now of the innumerable pourings of gins, the tiny rituals of swizzle sticks. It made me chuckle. He's written a wonderful review that totally understands the novel and understands its reticence. To go back to your question, yeah, the thing about Emily is she does start to emerge from the shadows as being more than an amanuensis to Evan. But I like to think that that revelation happens very quietly as Emily's own voice, actually. There's a lot made, isn't there, in fiction of reveal, and a bit like as she says there in the passage I just read, you know, the big moment, the confrontation, and then she understood that moment. I remember having a conversation with Jim Kalman about how we loathe the word suddenly in fiction. Suddenly, he was aware that. So yeah, I think everything about Emily comes out very gradually and slowly, a bit almost perhaps like watching a photograph develop in a dark room. But yes, her voice is there.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's because there is so much made of the pubs they choose to go to. And I live in West London, so I was very much chuckling over those and the sort of fad of gin. And that's become quite over the top. But, you know, because it's, Evan feels his love, this moment of ping, as he describes it, is so epic. And it is such an epic story. And we're waiting. And it's sort of like we see Emily as if you're coming around a corner and things are only revealed bit by bit by bit. You only see as much as you're given right then, which is a really lovely way. And it is unexpected and really fun. Something we started talking about before we started recording was what's not included in the novel. Like we definitely get to laugh, we get laugh with, at these people completely absorbed in their very sort of small suburban world of West London and down in Richmond, that situation in Richmond as it is described. Tell me why that was on purpose.
First of all, let me say I'm a great fan of the imagination. Going back to your earlier remark in your question about the fact of its gin-soaked pages, this book, you know, I make everything up. And when I was locked away in my study writing Caroline's Bikini, making up the entire story from scratch, I decided to have these two meet in pubs, and I thought that they would drink gin and tonic. That would be their kind of drink of choice. And as the book went on and I went into it, I realised that these gins were becoming fancier and fancier, and I had great fun playing with that and naming the gin and naming the tonic and so on. I arrived at my publisher's to give him the manuscript, and Lee said, after he'd read it, "Oh, and great that you got the gin thing too." I had no idea, Donna, that the gin thing had happened while I'd been away in my lonely, imaginative place. And of course, now I know that, yeah, that's a great big kind of fashion thing going on. I thought it was all happening in my head. But this fits in with the role, perhaps, of fiction in our real world. Muriel Spark, the great Muriel Spark, said in one of the lectures that she gave towards the end of her life that she thought that comedy was the only honourable art form left. She thought there was no place for novels that emoted or set up the themes and anxieties of the day as their stories, just so that people may emote along with them or have empathy, but actually do nothing at all about it. Let the book or the fiction, as it were, do all that empathising for you. No, she thought that comedy was the way that we might keep ourselves alive as intellectuals and as ethical individuals, and that by laughing we might think about the serious things that are going on in our lives. And by rigorously locating my novel in the world of West London, even though we do see, don't we, a kind of downward spiral as poor Evan descends into the pit of his great unrequited love affair and becomes more and more derelict and ill and a shadow of his former self, and the pubs and the gin they drink become a grim reflection of that. Even so, this is a comedy, and there are massive absences in it. And it's my hope that as the reader might be laughing along, the reader might also be thinking about some of the absences in that text.
And is it, do you think, because laughter makes us a little uncomfortable and provokes our thoughts more?
Yeah.
Because if we're moaning, as you say, we don't have to really... It's sort of like liking something on Facebook. So I obviously solved the problem since I liked it on Facebook. But so that we've sort of emoted out, as it were. And that by laughing, we actually have to think about why we're laughing.
Yeah, I think that's... I mean, John Carey wrote a terrific book a while ago now called The Violent Effigy about Charles Dickens, about his use of humour, and the idea that the laugh is there as an awful, almost violent, irrepressible response to some things that are actually really, really awful, but that behind, in the vacuum that laughter leaves, is a place where serious thinking can go on, and a kind of an individual response, rather than something that's been rhetorically fixed to have happened from the way the story and the structure's been set up from the novel.
Is it difficult to set out to write something funny?
Gosh, you know, it gave me enormous pleasure. I mean, here's the thing. When I was a child, I read these books called the Susan books by a woman called Jane Shore. I've just found out she died on the Isle of Arran only in 2000, and all these years have passed and I could have met her. That makes me feel very sad. The Susan books were just awesomely, deliciously funny, and I read them all through my childhood with my sister. We would read them out loud and laugh out loud. And then in turn I read them to my children when they were little, and they still adore them, and we still have to have ritual rereadings of the Susan books. And I have to say, I was channeling the tone of Susan in the writing of this book, and it gave me a great deal of pleasure. A huge amount of, you know, dependent clauses and a playing with tone and shifts of tone, the odd plucking of an adverb, these kinds of things that aren't afforded you when you're trying to create a different kind of text. In my last book, I was trying to find a form of fiction that might equate to a kind of particular kind of music. No, my task this time was very different, and that did give me a great deal of pleasure.
It sounds like a bit like it was a sort of a style of coming home.
Not sure about that, because I'll never probably write another comedy. All of my books are different. So to that extent, you know, there is no home for me. The home, I loved Edward Said's idea that the writer is constantly, you know, building that house in the next book, building the house of words. And Milan Kundera talks about, at the same time, that we knock the last house down. So to that extent, maybe not so much coming home, but I can tell you, yes, it did give me, I mean, I had a smile on my face as I was writing Caroline's Bikini, and I just adore all of the characters. And I had a great deal of fun with the whole thing. Even though, as I say, the book itself is very, very serious.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the structure of the book a bit and why you chose to do it that way.
Okay. Well, the book started as a short story that I wrote, and I finished it, and it was perfectly good, and I knew that I could get it published in all kinds of places. But I also knew there was nothing about the story that excited me. It was the kind of story that had been written before, and John Cheever had written it. And why write another short story like John Cheever? Because John Cheever's the bomb, right? So I ditched the idea of the story, but what I couldn't ditch was the title, Caroline's Bikini. Everything about that title pressed every single green button in my imagination. And I just kept fiddling with it and fiddling with it. And then what I realized was that Caroline's Bikini was a story about a story being made. And once I knew that it was about someone talking about Caroline Beresford and that bikini of hers, as we then find out does appear in the book, then I got it, and then I had a way in. And then, as with all my books, I have a sort of synesthesia that I imagine the book as another thing. And what I could see with Caroline's Bikini was that it was a little whirring kind of engine, a little golden engine of clicks and whirs and endless turning. Once you switched it on, it wasn't going to stop. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Off it goes. And then I knew that was it. That was going to be the structure. Ready, steady, go with these little sections. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Running within each. And I also knew, too, from the outset that it would have reference to a wider world, as indicated by notes and further material, it's called in the book, that reach in turn, I hope, to the real world around us.
What was your path to writing?
Well, that's a very long and complicated question, but I'll give you a short answer. I've always written, you know, since I was a little girl. And my granny was a writer, and she always encouraged that, and I used to read my things aloud to her, and I would have them be published in little Scottish magazines where she had her own work published. So it's just something I'd always have always done, you know. I just don't feel entirely myself if I don't have something on the go.
Can you tell me, because I was a huge Catherine Mansfield fan.
Oh, lucky you.
And I always did wonder what she would have done had she lived a bit longer.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Mm.
But so if you could talk to me a little bit about your book, My Catherine Mansfield Project, because I was quite intrigued when I was looking at that.
I'm always delighted to talk about Catherine Mansfield, and she's always been a huge inspiration to me, again, since childhood. My mother used to read the stories aloud, and the school I went to in New Zealand kind of incorporated one of her early homes, and we had Mansfield scholars in the English department at that school. So I was very lucky to have this wonderful kind of modernist education from a young age, in a way that I realised, actually, once I came to Oxford, wasn't necessarily the case. In the UK, I was kind of shocked. I was shocked at the absence of Mansfield and Woolf from a lot of, you know, reading lists from my peers and so on. Yeah, it's a great honour. I've just been invited to be patron of the Catherine Mansfield Society, which is wonderful for me because it means I get a chance to talk about her even more. But the Catherine Mansfield Project was as a result of being invited to take up a fellowship in Wellington, where I was born and where, of course, she was born and brought up, to go back to Wellington and to think about Mansfield. And I wasn't sure what kind of writing I would make when I arrived there. But as I started work on something, I realised it was something that was sort of like an essay that involved short stories and involved non-fiction and involved reflection, fragment and this kind of thing. And yes, was also a kind of a sort of a love letter, I suppose, to this writer that's been such an enormous influence and inspiration.
And she, like you and like me, was a transplant. And what effect did you see of that in her writing? And does that have an effect on your writing?
Well, actually, you know, there's a section in my Catherine Mansfield project that addresses that subject entirely. This idea that what I loved about her work as a child was the way she seemed to conjoin what I might call the here and the there. So the way I put it, I think, was she planted a cabbage tree in the middle of Russell Square. Mm-hmm. She made something other in a familiar, very London literary environment, and vice versa, actually. To her, you know, the so-called New Zealand stories, we are given streaks of what feels very much like a kind of London literary life as well. So these kinds of conjoinings gave a great deal of pleasure to me, that one didn't need to be fixed in a certain place and so on, that imagination could make of the place in words the real thing.
And also that those connections that you make, you can just have them, you know, and trust that we will go with you.
The imagination again,
yes.
You see.
Yeah.
I think we've lost sight of it. I think the novel has become far too obsessed with the real, the mimetic project, you know, the holding a mirror up to nature, all of that. And along with it, all of the oodles of research that go on into creating things that are historically accurate and of our time, whatever. I'm not saying that any of these things aren't important and interesting. Of course they are. But it's the idea that the poor novel's been stuck with doing that and very little else. What's happened to the imagination? What's happened to our ability to open a book and go diving in and to make things up for ourselves and to have to figure it out? And yes, to sometimes feel very disoriented and to feel angry sometimes and fed up, but all the time to be engaged and thinking and active and ethically and imaginatively engaged.
I must say, I always had the feeling, reading Catherine Mansfield, that there was, I don't know whether it was youthfulness, but there was there was a rules-breaking thing there, because it wasn't conventional. And it remains so breathless in that way.
Mm, in the morning the chairs came. That's how I sum up Catherine Mansfield. No one else writes a sentence like that. Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself. Okay. But it's not the same as in the morning the chairs came.
Yes, fantastic. I cannot wait to see what happens when you come out of the cupboard the next time.
I can't wait myself. No,
exactly. We shall see. Thank you so much, Kirsty, for your generosity.
Great, great pleasure. Thanks, Donna.
Thank you.
Great. Lovely questions.